From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we put China's suppressed democracy movement into focus with some history. Jonathan Spence is one of America's leading authorities on China and the author of the new book, In Search of Modern China. Also today, we meet Vikram Seth, an Indian poet who thinks there's nothing reactionary about rhyming metered verse. In fact, he's written a whole rhyming novel. Maureen Corrigan reviews new memoirs by two women who examine their marriages, writer Hetty Jones and film critic Molly Haskell. And we remember jazz tenor saxophonist Dexter Gordon, who has died at the age of 67. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Dave Pignanelli reports.
It was a race against time high above Earth today. Discovery's astronauts pulled the Hubble Space Telescope out of the orbiter's cargo bay early this morning and then battled all day long to spread open the telescope's solar panels. Ground controllers sent many signals by way of computer to unfurl the panels, but to no avail. NASA then readied astronauts Catherine Sullivan and Bruce McCandless for a spacewalk to unfurl the panels by hand. Just as the two were to receive their orders, it happened. Computer commands were received by the telescope, the solar panels opened, and were pointed toward the sun. Time was a major consideration. Without the panels, the batteries would have gone dead, leaving the $1.5 billion instrument frozen in space. Hubble was released from the shuttle's grip at 3:38 Eastern Time, more than 2 hours behind schedule. Hubble is now floating on its own 380 miles above the Earth. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Orlando.
Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro celebrated her inauguration today by declaring a political amnesty and ending the military draft. Mrs. Chamorro also announced that she'll retain General Humberto Ortega as head of the army, but that she'll assume the position of defense minister. On Capitol Hill today, Secretary of State James Baker repeated the president's position that he will not use economic sanctions against Moscow over the Lithuania issue at this time. At the White House, President Bush brushed off criticism of his policy. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports from the White House.
Although some congressional leaders are calling on the president to do something to express U.S. disapproval of Soviet actions in Lithuania, President Bush again indicated his unwillingness to act against the Soviets. His decision to take no action was denounced in Lithuania. At a picture-taking session this morning at the White House, a reporter asked the president if he would care to defend his policy. The president replied that he didn't need any defense, that his policy and decision regarding Lithuania have strong support from the American people. That's who I work for, said Mr. Bush. When asked, what about the Lithuanian people, the president did not respond. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Prices on Wall Street scored their first advance today in six sessions. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 12 points to close at 2,666.44. This is NPR News. The five remaining inmates holding out in Britain's riot-torn Strangeway prison surrendered today, ending a 25-day takeover. The five prisoners gave themselves up after a police raiding party cornered them on a roof without food or water. The uprising at Strangeways began on April 1st as a protest against overcrowding and poor living conditions at the prison. It sparked disturbances at 11 other prisons across Britain. Britain has the largest per capita prison population in Europe. The rebellions have prompted calls for the prison system to be overhauled. The censorship issue is coming up again in Cincinnati. In the wake of the controversy over photographs by the late Robert Mapplethorpe, music is now being targeted. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
Hamilton County Sheriff Simon Lease is threatening to file obscenity charges against record stores selling copies of a tape by the rap group 2 Live Crew called Be As Nasty As They Wanna Be. Lee says the words in the song are obscene.
It's beyond the protection of the First Amendment. isn't any jury, in my opinion, would find any different.
Lee says only one store in Hamilton County was selling the tape and has since removed it. A Florida man brought the tape to the attention of Cincinnati officials after hearing about the city's fight against obscenity in connection with the Mapplethorpe controversy. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
Jazzman Dexter Gordon, a pioneering tenor saxophone player, died today in a Philadelphia hospital. He was 67. Don Lukoff, a spokesman for Blue Note Records, said that Gordon died of kidney failure. Gordon had been admitted to the hospital last month for treatment of cancer of the larynx. He was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the 1986 movie Round Midnight. Gordon had recently finished another movie, Awakenings, with Robert De Niro. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. I'm Corey Flintoff.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although communism is losing its grip in some parts of the world, China's government continues to hold on to its power through the use of violent repression. My guest, Jonathan Spence, has studied and written about China for the past 30 years. He's just published his 9th book on the country. It's a history of the past 4 centuries, from the decline of the Ming Dynasty in the early 1600s up to last year's events at Tiananmen Square. It's titled The Search for Modern China. Spence is a professor of history at Yale University. I asked him why he thinks the democracy movements in Eastern Europe succeeded while China's failed.
The Chinese have been reflecting on this a lot, those of them who are mostly those in exile now in this country and Europe, though people in China itself are also talking about it. They're kind of rather fascinated, I mean, appalled and fascinated by the timing, that in a sense they feel that perhaps though they were suppressed so savagely in the spring and summer of 89, maybe they helped kind of spark an awareness that it can be done, you know, elsewhere in Europe. And some of them said a bit nostalgically, if only they had held off, if they'd cooled it last spring, if none of this had happened, then maybe now they would be having their own, you know, huge liberation following on from the Eastern European model. So the arguments can really go both ways. One tragedy for many Chinese is that for a generation now, they've been looking for some way in which to kind of give some sense of leadership in the world. I feel, you know, Chinese are patriotic and ambitious for themselves and proud of their history in many ways. And some of them have pointed out that if only Deng Xiaoping and his senior leaders had continued on this fairly economically moderate, reform-minded policy and even given an inch in the political arena and had not had any of this bloody crackdown, then China would be seen as the pace setter for the whole of Eastern Europe and the liberation that's come since. And the Chinese could hold their head up really proud all over the world and say, look what we've achieved, look what we've done by our pragmatic approach to politics, our ability to modify a communist society in new directions.
You're saying the Chinese leaders could have held their heads up, but do you think that there's any sense of shame or embarrassment on the part of China's leaders that they initiated this crackdown against the student and tightened things up?
That's a sharp way of putting it, actually. I was thinking in a sense of them being proud of their achievement internationally. If you look at it in terms of their own guilt or regret, no, I think there's a surprising bloody-mindedness on their part, simply saying they did what they had to do, this tenacity of calling it all a counter-revolutionary rebellion, blaming a few ruffians and hooligans when all over the world people saw millions of people from all walks of life day after day after day in these demonstrations. There's something really defiant, I think, about the refusal to acknowledge any meaningfulness to the demonstration. So your point is well taken. Those are two different ways of looking at the same problem.
Do you know how aware the Chinese are of, for instance, the recent events in Romania, the overthrow of Ceausescu? How good is the news about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union in China?
Well, apparently these events are covered to a certain extent in their own official press. But there is not usually very much discussion of the involvement of the masses. It's more presented as kind of a sort of creative modification of an old over-centralized regime looking for economic freedoms and so on. There's an attempt, I think, to keep it muted, and to suggest that the same kind of thing is not needed in China at all because of the leadership and tenacity of their party. In other words, they are avoiding the same kinds of mistakes that the others are making, is their claim.
Well, so in the Soviet Union now, you have reforms being initiated. In China, they're still suffering under a crackdown. Right now, Li Peng is in the Soviet Union, and
yes,
this is the first visit by a Chinese head of state to the Soviet Union in 26 years.
It's since Mao went, I suppose, near the end of his life. Is that right? That would make sense, I think.
Can you explain some of the history behind the distrust between the Soviet Union and China?
Yeah, that's a very intriguing story for the historians. It's a pretty tangled one. But again, if historians are allowed to roam around a bit, I mean, the original borderline, the sort of intergovernmental situation of China, again, is one reason I like to go back in my own book to the 17th century, because that's when the borders, as they consist, as they look now, were pretty much drawn up in the 1680s. So Russia and China had a sort of an early treaty relationship from the 17th century. Then Russia became very self-aggrandizing at Chinese expense in the 19th century as China began to weaken. So Russia became very problematic to the Chinese. It seized large areas on the sort of near the area around Vladivostok and also in western China. By 1920, though, the Bolshevik Revolution had transformed the idea of Russia in Chinese radicals' eyes, because this enormous Tsarist autocracy suddenly showed that it could be overthrown by revolutionary passions and a small group of dedicated reformers. So Chinese seized on the new Soviet Union as very different from the old Russia. And as Lenin began to develop the international branch of the Soviet Union's government through what was called the Comintern or the Communist International, he figured that China would be an admirable place to operate. So the Communist Party of China was founded with direct Russian aid and assistance in 1921. So the Chinese can point, in a sense, to the fact that the Soviet Union was the begetter of their own Communist Party. But in the mid-20s, and this is where the tension really begins, what happens is that Mao Zedong, as leader or emerging leader of the Communist Party, is really very much at odds with the Comintern instructions that are coming first from Lenin and then later from Stalin to the Chinese revolutionaries. And as Mao began to shift slowly more and more towards realizing that the revolution would probably only survive if it was on a basis of peasant activism, rural militia, scattered guerrilla units and so on, and the Comintern was still looking for the armed insurrection of the urban proletariat and a highly organized Communist Party elite system in the cities, really you got a very, very startling dissonance between Mao and Moscow. And that, I think, has been part of the problem ever since. So if you want to look at the roots of distrust between the two countries, one is kind of geopolitical and is 19th century, and one is internal organizational, and that is from the 1920s.
My guest is historian Jonathan Spence, and he's the author of a new book about China called The Search for Modern China. China is a country of great respect for elders. Was there a special significance to having college students leading a rebellion against leaders who were in their 80s?
Yes, this is. I don't know, that to me is a very intriguing question, and it forces one to try and think through the life experience of some of the people we're considering here, trying to decide what was the emotional impact of this. You're dealing with students in the late 1980s, of course, who've grown up entirely, not only just in the People's Republic of China, but in most cases since the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. This is very much a second revolutionary or post-revolutionary generation. And many of their senior leaders saw them as sort of spoilt or arrogant young people who'd had it good. From the Western point of view, sort of living in the modern People's Republic is not obviously having it good. And there were always very real tensions, a high level of poverty, very competitive atmosphere in the schools, very bad working conditions in universities. Yet to the leaders themselves, who'd fought their way through for 30, 40 years, these youngsters were inexperienced and unaware of the deeper problems facing the country. The leadership now in power, and that is still true of Deng Xiaoping and people like Yang Shangkun, the president, though it's not true of people like the younger premier Li Peng, who's now in Moscow. But this older group have actually been pretty much fighting for their lives since about 1922, 1923. They have seen life in all its sort of terrifying complexity and violence. They've nearly all lost family members, their closest friends, in the most violent and horrific ways. And they feel, I think, particular claim on the emotions and loyalty of the young, because they feel they saved China from the miserable state it was in. And in The Search for Modern China, one of the things I try and discuss is the very real awfulness of life, you know, for the poor in China. I do try and explain why a revolution took place, in other words. I don't just sort of dismiss that. And the older leaders now, I think, are desperately, in a way, trying to keep alive this sense that they understood what China was going through. They knew what was best. They made the definition with Chairman Mao's help. And once Chairman Mao had died, they tried to modify his policies but keep the general direction, the forward momentum of China going. And their whole life experience, their whole passion for the revolution is then brusquely shunted aside by this whole group of 20-year-olds who start brandishing about these Western slogans for participatory democracy. So the bitterness, you know, the lack of meeting of the minds here is horrendous, I think.
Is this kind of a generation gap, in a way, new to China?
Well, you could say the whole idea of a student protest is new. And again, we can chart that. The first time that people really began to listen to students' views seriously in China, I would place around the period of 1905 to 1910. Until then, as I've talked about the tradition of intellectual protest, that's mature adults. In fact, men, by definition, because in the old Chinese educational system, it was only the men who got advanced education, and only men were allowed in the bureaucracy. So intellectual protest in the public forum was largely what we might say middle-aged or elderly males protesting against the state. But in the early 20th century, all this changed as women began to get advanced education in China for the first time in very large numbers, and Chinese students also began to go overseas. So around about 1905, 1910, you got very large numbers of Chinese young men and women studying in Japan, in the United States, and in Western Europe. And they formed a very volatile political mix. And it was these young people returning to China who began to demonstrate and to lobby and to protest, to form student unions, to begin to try and have more say in their own schools and colleges.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about China and your studies of China. And my guest is Jonathan Spence. He's the author of the new book, The Search for Modern China. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jonathan Spence is my guest. His new book, The Search for Modern China, covers four centuries of Chinese history from the decline of the Ming Dynasty to the present. Spence has written eight other books on China and is a professor of history at Yale. How many times have you been to China, and what have your most recent trips been?
Yeah, I've been to Taiwan once and to the People's Republic of China four times. I originally did my research in Taiwan as a student when I couldn't get to China. I guess pretty much no one could. It was the early 60s, and it was the time between the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. And then I went to China itself 2 years after President Nixon's visit. That was in 1974. I first went with a delegation from Yale, And it was still very much the Cultural Revolutionary period. We were still given great lectures on the Maoist line. One felt spectacularly fishbowl-like going to China. If anybody who's there at that time remembers just being stared at in complete amazement by the Chinese seeing any foreigners at all allowed in their country. And we, I fear, gazed back with equal kind of blissful incomprehension. It was a time of great fascination. I mean, it was extraordinary having worked in a field for this long to be only now going to China for the first time. The Chinese made you feel very alien. I might share one story with you because it's still very vivid to me about my first visit to, you know, the famous Forbidden City, the mm-hmm. great inner palace complex, which, of course, I sort of felt I'd inherited by my researches, which were mainly on the 17th and 18th century China in those days. And I'd always just dreamed of being able to walk into the great Forbidden City of Peking, if possible, at sunrise, you know, with the sun coming up above the great marble palaces and this kind of thing. And I was really very sentimental about this, how all aged China would come back to me. Instead, we were hurtled right into the middle of the Forbidden City in a huge sort of air-conditioned Western bus with a blaring horn scattering all the Chinese aside. And it was emotionally awful for me. I mean, maybe you think that's, again, it sounds a bit ironic, but all my dreams of being kind of inconspicuous, you know, the foreign scholar visiting the great tradition, was blasted aside. And as we climbed out of the bus, this whole group of Westerners, you could really see the Chinese crowds saying, you know, look at those SOBs, the way they treat us, they're still just sort of the old imperialists. But what was so ironic was it was the communist, you know, organizers who'd sort of made this the way of rushing us into the shrine, as it were.
You studied at Cambridge in England, you studied
yes.
at Yale in the United States,
right.
but you also studied with a Chinese scholar named, and you can correct my pronunciation, Mr. Fang, okay.
Fang Zhaoying, yes.
How did you find him? Why did you want to study with him?
Oh, that actually was very crucial to my whole growth as a scholar. I came to Yale and started doing Chinese there. I'd never actually done anything to do with Chinese studies in England. And eventually I was admitted to the PhD program in Chinese history, and I was asked who I would like to study with most, you know, to get the training in textual sources, in difficult Chinese traditional historical texts and so. And I went through a biographical dictionary of the whole Qing dynasty. That's the last Chinese dynasty that ruled from 1644 to 1912. And this biographical dictionary contained really hundreds of very, very scholarly and brilliant biographies of major Chinese historical figures from the 17th century onward. Usually you dip into a biographical dictionary. I just started with the A's and read through to the Y's. There weren't any Z's there. And on the way, I jotted down the name of the author of any biographical entry I thought was really good. And at the end of this proceeding, which took a couple of weeks, I guess, I had something like 90 entrants under Mr. Fang Zhaoying's name and about 20 entrants under Du Lianzhe's name and a couple of other scattered references to other scholars. So I went to my director and teacher at Yale, and she said, well, do you know who you want to study with? And I said, yes, I'd like to study with this man, Fang Zhaoying. And she said, oh, and supposing he's not available? And I said, well, in that case, I'd like to study with Mr. Du Lianzhe. And she roared with laughter and said, well, Mr. Du is in fact Mrs. Fang. And when I'd sorted this out, I realized this was a husband and wife team. I said, well, where are they? And she said, well, they're in Australia. So I said, oh, my God, Australia. Why is that? And she said, well, they're working in the library in Canberra. So in those days, Mr. Fang, who was typical of a group of Chinese who did not like the People's Republic, did not like Taiwan, and did not like Hong Kong, you know, and couldn't get a job he found satisfactory in Europe or the States, so he'd ended up sort of in a rather limbo land in Australia. So I wrote to Mr. Fang in Australia, just care of the library in Canberra, I guess, and said, could I come and be your student and study Qing Dynasty traditional documents and try and learn a little bit from you? And I got the most charming letter back in elegant longhand, English longhand, a few days later by airmail, saying, I'd be honoured to have you come and study with me, but I must warn you of one thing, I've never had a student. And I just couldn't believe it. I was just stunned that somebody with this knowledge and this brilliance, you know, had had the kind of scholarly life that meant they'd had no whole generation of new graduate students to train.
So what was different studying with Mr. Feng, who was a scholar but had never had a student and who wasn't affiliated with an academic institution? What was different studying with him than studying with a professor affiliated with an institution?
Maybe sometimes you'd set up a similar relationship with a professor in this country, but there he was working during the day. It was very informal. It put a fantastic amount of pressure on me. Mr. Feng had no idea what was a sensible load. I mean, you know, to give a student trying to learn Chinese documents. So he would, you know, hand me several chapters and say, why don't you just look through these? And at that stage, it would take me something like a day to do a page of these documents. And so I finally managed to persuade him to give me a little less. And then I would just go to work with dictionaries and glossaries. And then when I had done a few pages, he would take the time off from his work. And he would, so to speak, guide me through character by character, explaining the phrases, the historical background. He would kind of chant to himself as he read. And it was my first introduction to a scholar who really carried most of the tradition of Chinese history in his own head, so that he didn't really keep rushing up to the shelves all the time, as I would do with one of my own graduate students. Mr. Feng would kind of narrow his eyes and make sort of run his fingers through the air as if going down the page of Chinese text. And then he would murmur something about, I think you'll find this in chapter 793 of the Great Collected Statutes and so on of the Qing. And I would hardly take notes on that. He was always right.
You've used a Chinese word to describe your teacher, a word which translated in English means true teacher. What does that mean?
Oh, Lao Xiansheng. Yes, if Mr. Feng, my Lao Xiansheng. In the traditional Chinese society, most young scholars would have one person whom they really revered, who was of an older generation and had the knowledge that they hoped they might someday even faintly approximate. And though I would never, ever approximate Mr. Feng's knowledge, to me he was always my true Lao Xiansheng. That means it means sort of old master or old trusted one, in a sense. And that's how I've always revered him. And he was the man who gave me my Chinese name, which is the name that's used on the little seal in the Search for Modern China. And that Chinese name given to me by my Lao Xiansheng is something I will always treasure for the rest of my life.
What does the name translate to?
Shi Jingqian. Shi is, in fact, the Chinese word for history, which is also a surname, oddly enough. Jing means to emulate or to have great admiration for something. And Qian is a complicated character that was the given name of one of China's most magnificent 2nd century BC historians, a man called Sima Qian. And I'd enormously admired Sima Qian's work when I was a graduate student, and I told Mr. Feng about it. Qian can also mean to move about from place to place. And of course, to try and emulate the historians of the past, I had travelled from England to America and then to Australia to be with Mr. Feng. So it was both a witty and an erudite and a very, very charming gesture of his to draw all these ideas together. And it more and more, that again is what I would say is at the heart of the Lao Xiansheng relationship. It was a generous and amusing and courteous thing for him to do.
Jonathan Spence, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, dear.
Jonathan Spence is the author of a new history of China titled The Search for Modern China. He's also a professor of history at Yale. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk about the Intifada. My guest will be Ehud Yahari. He covers Middle East affairs for Israeli television. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's tenor saxophonist Dexter Gordon, who has died at the age of 67. Dexter Gordon will be remembered for his playing and for his Academy Award-nominated performance in Round Midnight. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead looks back on Gordon's life and music. It's rare enough for a poet to write in rhymes anymore. It was even more unusual when Vikram Seth wrote a novel in verse. Coming up, a talk with the Indian writer. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the autobiographies of writer Hetty Jones and film critic Molly Haskell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Nicaragua's new president, Violeta Chamorro, was sworn in at a rowdy ceremony in a baseball stadium in Managua today. Insults and objects were hurled at both Chamorro and outgoing President Daniel Ortega as the 11-year rule of the Sandinista Revolution came to an end. NPR's Alan Tomlinson was there.
It was not only Nicaragua's leaders who had to run a gauntlet of abuse as they entered the noisy stadium. Sandinista loyalists, angered at U.S. backing for the rebel Contras, chanted assassin at American Vice President Dan Quayle as he joined the foreign guests. A barrage of water bags rained down on President-elect Chamorro when she made her entrance, but the mood calmed down as she and Daniel Ortega embraced each other in a symbolic gesture of national reconciliation. Ortega centered his farewell speech on a call for all Nicaraguans to work for the disarmament of the Contras. Chamorro focused on demilitarizing the whole country, including much of the Sandinista People's Army. She declared that she personally would occupy the post of defense minister, but in a controversial move, she also announced that Ortega's brother, General Humberto Ortega, would be staying on as army chief to reduce military tensions. In Managua, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Chinese Prime Minister Li Feng told reporters in Moscow today that Soviet-Chinese relations are back to normal, downplaying reports of major policy disagreements between the two countries. Tonight, Li is wrapping up the first visit to the Kremlin by a Chinese leader in a quarter century. Benjamin Rowe reports from Moscow.
Li acknowledged that the Chinese and the Soviets differed on communist ideology, but said every country needs to decide for itself how to build socialism, depending on its own reality. The Chinese leader scoffed at reports that the Chinese Communist Party had secretly denounced Gorbachev for his perestroika-style reforms and for permitting the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. Today, he said there was no denying that there had been dramatic changes in European countries, but that it was too early to tell if they were truly abandoning socialism. And, Li said, Gorbachev had persuaded him that perestroika was of a socialist orientation. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hill says the U.S. has now reached a tentative agreement with Japan to provide greater access for U.S. wood products to Japanese markets. This agreement is expected to increase exports of U.S. wood products to Japan by between $1 and $2 billion a year. Hill said the agreement offers major benefits to U.S. wood exporters. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 12 points to close at 2,666.44 on volume of some 133 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Dexter Gordon is dead at the age of 67. The jazz tenor saxophonist had been suffering from cancer of the larynx, but it was kidney failure that ended his life this morning in a Philadelphia hospital. Gordon was one of the creators of the style known as bop and one of the most influential tenor players of the 40s and 50s. He was an expatriate during much of the 60s and 70s. Even if you don't listen to much jazz and aren't familiar with Gordon's music, you may remember him for his portrayal of a jazz musician in the 1986 film Round Midnight. This performance marked the first time a musician was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor. Fresh Air jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is with us to remember Dexter Gordon. This is how Gordon sounded in 1945. The recording is Blow, Mr. Dexter. ¶¶ Kevin, what was distinctive about Dexter Gordon's playing?
I guess you'd have to say that Dexter was a consolidator. I mean, he took the kind of really booting lines that Lester Young played and combined them with a somewhat larger saxophone sound that Coleman Hawkins, the first great tenor player, had. Part of it was sort of a robust sound which came out of rhythm and blues. And I think his ability to put all those things together and combine it with bebop harmony in the late 40s was a thing that made him really influential on later players like Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane.
Dexter Gordon lived abroad for many years. Why did he become an expatriate, and how long did he live away from the States?
Dexter never really intended to become an expatriate. He got an engagement at Ronnie Scott's in London in 1962, which lasted a month. And while he was in London, he made some contacts, which led to him getting a job in Paris. While he was in Paris, it led to him going to Copenhagen, a city which he liked very much, and he sort of stayed there for a while. He wasn't really conscious of the fact that he had become an expatriate until a couple of years later when he read a story by Ira Gittler in Downbeat, which referred to him as the expatriate Dexter Gordon. He stayed in Europe until pretty much exclusively until 1976. Well, I shouldn't say pretty much exclusively. He did come back to the States and do some touring here. It wasn't like he totally dropped off the face of the earth. And I should also mention his recordings were still coming out in the United States. The Blue Note label put out a lot of Dexter recordings in the 1960s. There's one album from 1962 called Our Man in Paris, which has Dexter playing with Bud Powell. Maybe we should listen to a little bit of music from that.
Dexter Gordon returned to the States in 1976. Do you know why he came back?
Well, the main thing that brought Dexter back was an engagement at the Village Vanguard, the famous New York City nightclub, in December of 1976. And to his surprise, he was very warmly received in the States. A live recording was made by Columbia Records, an album called Homecoming, which became very successful, got him a lot of exposure, and led to much more work in the States. And for the next several years after that, he pretty much had a foot on each continent. He was working quite a bit, both here and abroad. One of the nice things about Dexter Gordon's resurgence, both as a musician and quote-unquote as a movie star, is that he was one of the jazz musicians who actually got to see his early recordings put in a proper context while he was still alive.
Do you think that people who saw Dexter Gordon in Round Midnight got an accurate impression of who he was, both as a person and as a musician?
I would say as a musician, he was past his prime. In fact, that's one of the problems I have with the movie, is where his French pal goes home at one point and says, Dale Turner played like a god tonight. Well, Dale Turner really wasn't playing like a god at that point. I mean, it was pretty late in life, and Dexter was not playing all that well. I think personally, he came across much better. I mean, the camera really soaked him up, and I think he really, in some instinctive way, knew how to play to the camera. That kind of really distinctive syncopated walk that he had came across really nicely in the film, and that kind of really lazy and relaxed vocal quality that he had really came across. He did a really good job of injecting Dexter Gordon into the character of Dale Turner.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. Dexter Gordon has died at the age of 67. ¶¶ This is Fresh Air. Poets these days write in rhyme and meter. Vikram Seth not only writes poems that rhyme, but he wrote his novel, The Golden Gate, in metered verse. The 1986 novel was a love story set in contemporary San Francisco. Seth wrote it while in graduate school in California. Seth was born in Calcutta and spent most of his youth in India. He studied in England before coming to the U.S. His new collection of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight, is written in rhyme. I asked him why he writes in a style that most contemporary poets have abandoned.
I suppose when I was very young, the idea that poetry didn't rhyme would have come to me as a bit of a shock. You know, my nursery rhymes, well, being nursery rhymes, they were in rhyme. And most of the poetry that we are brought up on in India is fairly conventional poetry, lots of Wordsworth, lots of Tennyson, that sort of stuff. So I was rather startled when, in fact, I started reading some modern poetry or poetry written in this century, which didn't rhyme. And then I was even more startled when I found out that those who did try to rhyme their poetry were sort of considered passé or reactionary in some sense. So with desperate eagerness, I started lopping off all the rhymes in my poems and started writing in unrhymed and unmetered forms. And it took me a little while before I came around to the recognition that I shouldn't constrain myself. That is, if a poem came out in free verse, well and good. And if, in fact, it struck me that it was best suited to rhyme and meter, then that's what I should do. In other words, I should just let the poem breathe the way that it wanted to.
Let me ask you to read one of the poems that's collected in your new volume. And this poem is called Sure. Soon. You can introduce it for us if you'd like.
All right. Perhaps I'll say a few words after I've read the poem, so as not to kind of precondition anyone. I shall die soon, I know. This thing is in my blood. It will not let me go. It saps my cells for food. It soaks my nights in sweat and breaks my days in pain. No hand or drug can treat these limbs for love or gain. Love was the strange first cause that bred grief in its seed, and gain knew its own laws to fix its place and breed. He whom I love, thank God, won't speak of hope or cure. It would not do me good. He sees that I am sure. He knows what I have read and will not bring me lies. He sees that I am dead. I read it in his eyes. How am I to go on? How will I bear this taste? My throat cased in white spawn, these hands that shake and waste. Stay by my steel ward bed and hold me where I lie. Love me when I am dead and do not let me die. Well, there are two things about the poem. The first thing is the obvious one, I suppose, that it's about AIDS, and someone who's dying of it, and this poem is written in the voice of someone who's affected by the disease. The second thing, and this is really nothing to do with the power of the poem, but it might be just of interest, is that every word in that poem is exactly one syllable long. And the reason I didn't want to say either of those two things before I read the poem was that poems need to sort of reveal their own subjects as they're read. And secondly, this sort of stylistic aspect of it, for instance, the fact that every word is one syllable long, that could become obtrusive to the listener if they were conscious of it beforehand.
Well, I'll confess that I've read that poem several times and I didn't notice that all the words were one syllable long.
Well, I'm very glad of that.
Oh, you're glad of that, huh?
Well, I'm glad of that because I feel that, you know, if one has... I don't think art or form should bludgeon the reader or the listener. If it works, it should work quietly.
Well, what interested you in that form?
I just found the poem coming out like that. And I suppose, though this isn't something that I would lay too much weight on, that the breathlessness that maybe is associated with the subject of the poem, the difficulty of speech and of any kind of expenditure of energy, might perhaps have some relation to it.
What kind of structures have you been working with, or have you worked with, in your rhyming metered poems?
Well, the one that perhaps has influenced me the most, in that I wrote a whole book of, I guess, 300 pages in it, is what's known as the Pushkin stanza. And that's a stanza that was formed and immortalized by Alexander Pushkin, the great Russian poet and novelist. It's a 14-line stanza, rather like a sonnet, except that instead of having 5 feet like the standard Shakespearean sonnet, it has 4. So it goes sort of ta-dum, 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 ta-dum. I'd like to read this poem out. Or I hear your name is Terry Gross, or something like that. So it's got a 4-beat line. And it's got an elaborate rhyming pattern. But again, what pleased me about this meter, especially when I was reading Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, was that he can write about the most flippant things in this meter, and they take off, and then he can write about things that just have you in tears. And it's the same form. It's the same strict form.
Do you find it difficult to read metered rhyming verse and not have it sound really sing-song?
Has this got something to do with what I did just now?
Well, no, but even when you're it's like ta-tum, 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 ta-tum.
That's actually the sort of pedagogic explanation.
I was just emphasizing it.
But for instance, if I were reading, say, a stanza of, the Golden Gate, I would certainly not read it in that way. For instance, in a passage, John is complaining to Jan. He says, I'm young, employed, healthy, ambitious, sound, solvent, self-made, self-possessed, but all my symptoms are pernicious. The Dow Jones of my heart's depressed. The sunflower of my youth is wilting. The tower of my dreams is tilting. The zoom lens of my zest is blurred. The drama of my life's absurd. What is the root of my neurosis? I jog, eat brewer's yeast each day, and yet I feel life slip away. I wait your sapient diagnosis. I die, I faint, I fail, I sink. You need a lover, John, I think. It doesn't have to be read, you know. It should be read any you know, lively way.
Now, you've studied in England, America, and China. Have you found there to be really different teaching styles in each country?
I would say that one thing that struck me when I went from England, where I'd been an undergraduate, to America, where I was a graduate student, was this. There's a great amount of freedom given in England for people to sort of follow their own inclination, their own bent, their own interests. When I went to America as a graduate student, I found, oddly enough, I felt as if I was reverting to high school. There were lots of tests all the time, which is quite foreign to the English method of education. And there was a sense that you were continually striving for grades. Now, I don't think that was a very good idea, certainly with respect to certain subjects. It might work for certain scientific subjects, but not, I think, for literature, history, or even the subject that was my subject, economics.
Why did you study economics?
I got into university in England through the literature exams that they have. But there were, in those days, about 9 months between admission to university, at least that university, and entrance. So I wandered home, and I thought a little about things, and I realized I'd never really lose my taste for literature. Why was I going to spend 4 years studying it, especially since much of the curriculum would be reading criticism or reading books which I might have preferred to read more at leisure or at some other time in my life? Then I thought to myself, well, supposing I'm not going to study literature, what will I study? And I realized that economics would be an interesting subject, partly because I thought it might help me to understand the way the world worked, partly because my father, you know, works in business, and maybe it would help me understand the way his mind worked, and partly because I thought maybe it would help, you know, help mm-hmm. back home in India.
After living so many years in other countries, you've returned to India. What brought you yeah. back there?
Partly, I suppose, the fact that that I could afford to go back. And the second thing was, I suppose, I'd always told myself I'd go back. I wanted to be with the family. My folks are not, you know, very young. And I also wanted to write a novel set in India. But the fact was that although I thought that my degree in California would only stretch out for 4 years, I found year following year, and by the end of it was about 11 years. So I decided, okay, I'm getting out now. Book's been published. I can afford to get out. If I don't get out now, I don't know when I will. I was enjoying California so much, I could have stayed there forever.
Let me ask you to read one more poem. Would you read Round and Round for us? It's the first poem in your new collection.
Right. Round and Round. After a long and wretched flight that stretched from daylight into night, where babies wept and tempers shattered, and the plane lurched and whiskey splattered over my plastic food, I came to claim my bags from baggage claim. Around, the carousel went around. The anxious travelers sought and found their bags, intact or gently battered, but to my foolish eyes what mattered was a brave suitcase, red and small, that circled round, not mine at all. I knew that bag. It must be hers. We hadn't met in 7 years. And as the steel plates squealed and clattered, my happy memories chimed and chattered. An old man pulled it off the claim. My bags appeared. I did the same.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure, Terry. Thank you.
Vikram Seth's new volume of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Inauguration Day in Nicaragua. Violeta Chamorro is that country's new freely elected president. We'll talk with Vytautas Landsbergis, the president of Lithuania, who is disappointed but undeterred, he says, by the fact that President Bush has decided not to impose economic sanctions against the Soviet Union. Also, Dexter Gordon, the tenor saxophone player, has died at age 67 in a Philadelphia hospital. Gordon is a jazz legend. He was born in Los Angeles, came to New York with Lionel Hampton in the early 1940s, and spent more than a decade as an expatriate musician in Europe. He was also the star of the movie Round Midnight, which was about jazz musicians in Paris.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are two new memoirs by women writers, one by film critic Molly Haskell and the other by writer and editor Hetty Jones. But in telling their own stories, both women focus on the more famous men in their lives. Molly Haskell is married to film critic Andrew Saris, and Hetty Jones was married to the poet Leroy Jones, known now as Amiri Baraka. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has this review.
Throughout literary history, from St. Augustine's Confessions to Mein Kampf, autobiography has been pretty exclusively a male genre. Lots of poems and novels by women were published in the 18th century, but female autobiographies didn't flourish until the 20th. Recording your life story, after all, is an assertive, unladylike act. And as two new autobiographies remind us, it's still difficult for women to find their own voices. Molly Haskell calls her autobiography a salvaging act, and the term applies to Hetty Jones's story as well. Both women want to reclaim parts of themselves that they've lost in their marriages. But there's an uncomfortable irony here. Both books celebrate a woman's struggle for autonomy, but neither would have been as publishable were it not for the famous man present in the stories. These autobiographies are compelling, but not for the reason they want to be. Haskell and Jones try to describe their rediscovery of selfhood, but instead, their stories vividly detail how hard it is for a woman not to lose herself in what Emily Dickinson called that soft eclipse of marriage. Haskell was propelled into her quest for selfhood by a mysterious illness that struck her husband, Andrew Saris, in 1984. As his death becomes a constant threat, Haskell is panicked into recognizing her dependence on him. Haskell writes that she and Saris had become one of those couples who are so close you can't see the air between them. She insists that her own struggle to breathe became as desperate as her husband's. And in the last few pages of Love and Other Infectious Diseases, Haskell tells us that she's achieved healthy separateness. But given that her marriage is her story here, it's hard to believe that she's made a full recovery. One reason Hetty Jones was attracted to the black poet Leroy Jones was that he put lots of breathing space between her and her middle-class Jewish upbringing. They met in the late 50s, married, had two kids, and as Hetty writes, thought they were liberated from all that had gone before. But history, in the form of the Black Power movement, catches up with them. One day, Leroy tells Hetty that she can't come to the performance of his play Dutchman at Howard University. Why? Because she's white. The free zone of their marriage has been infiltrated by race, and they divorce. How I Became Hetty Jones is a painful story, but I was awed by Hetty's triumphant detachment from the betrayals of the past. She writes this about her father and her husband. Both these men first loved me for myself and then discarded me when that self no longer fit their daughter-wife image. Still, while they loved me, they sometimes saw in me more than I did, and for those times, I owe them. The problem here again is that Hetty collapses the 25 years of her life after Leroy into the last pages of her book. And before that, I want to know how this white woman ever came to be so strong-willed that she could marry a black man in the late 50s and the rest of the world be damned. It's a testimony to the power of both these autobiographies that I want to know these women better. Maybe in Volume 2, they'll tell us some other plots that also make up the stories of their lives.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Lugene DeJoseph. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Israeli journalist Ehud Ya'ari analyzes the causes and effects of the Intifada. We also meet writer Jessica Hagedorn. Her new novel is set amid the poverty and the opulence of the country she was raised in, the Philippines. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.